Welcome to The Common Share, a podcast about cooperative businesses. I'm Asa Marshall with Cooperatives First, an organization that promotes co-op business development in rural and Indigenous communities across Western Canada. We're recording in Saskatoon on Treaty 6 territory and the traditional homeland of the Métis. Across Canada, housing costs are rising. Housing cooperatives have often been used to provide stable, affordable housing, and more people are interested in how co-ops can work in this current environment. Union Cooperative is a new housing co-op in Waterloo, Ontario, that aims to provide permanent, affordable housing by having members collectively purchase properties. Its executive director, Sean Campbell, spoke to us about this co-op, how it works, and what it hopes to provide in the context of the ever-increasing cost of living.
Union Co-op is working to buy existing properties for permanent affordability through community ownership. So we're building on this legacy of nonprofit housing co-ops, where tenants in our model have dedicated board seats. But we also are building on the legacy of renewable energy co-ops that have been successful in raising tens of millions of dollars in Ontario and applying them towards renewable energy. We haven't seen that same approach yet applied towards affordable housing. So community members also have dedicated board seats and they can invest money within the co-op. We use that to form the down payment and to buy our first properties. The hope is that as we grow, we can be that missing middle between the great work done by charities and municipalities to provide deeply affordable housing and market rate rents. There's not a lot of places for folks who, you know, are able to live independently, are doing all the right things, are working a job or on OAS or other types of retirement payments, but just can't afford a spot to live. So that's what we're looking to do here at Union Co-op.
Sean told us how the co-op got started and why they decided that a cooperative was the right way to address this opportunity.
So I was actually really inspired by the work of the opportunity development cooperatives in Alberta, of Sangudo and Crow's Nest, and then seeing it be replicated down in the States in the Northeast Investment Cooperative and then the East Bay Permanent Real Estate Co-op. You know, it seemed like a really tangible tool for doing something meaningful about affordable housing. And we're all looking around and saying, you know, this is a big issue. But, you know, my background is working with nonprofits and charities, and it's so hard to raise the capital we need as a nonprofit or charity to deal with these bigger structural issues. And here in rural Alberta, you know, they've come up with this fantastic model to do just that and to help tackle these big issues in their community. That when the meatpacking plant was closing in Sangudo, they realized, hey, you know, we can come together and we can fix this problem by the community for the community. So what if we do the same thing, different context for housing here in Waterloo region? When we first got started, it was really because we were inspired by those other communities and we saw that they were all using the cooperative form for opportunity development cooperatives, but also renewable energy co-ops here locally. So it did seem like, you know, there was something special about the co-op model that warranted some extra attention. My partner is one of the founding members of a cooperative, a worker cooperative brewery here in town. So she was also a big inspiration for me in thinking, you know, I've seen this model work here locally. I've tasted the delicious beer that they've made cooperatively. So what if we use that same model? And as we started digging in deeper, we realized that co-ops in Ontario, specifically because they're each regulated provincially, but from my understanding, this is similar across country, across Canada, we have some real advantages for this type of work. So we can issue equity or debt, not just community bonds like nonprofits. And that's super important for a housing organization because banks want to see equity. They don't want to loan money for just debt that you're bringing in from investors. So that's one piece, preference shares that we can issue or actual equity. We can increase the return 1 year and decrease in another, balancing it out over the long term. So if a tenant moves on or there's a major repair, we're not at risk of default like we would with a community bond. I don't think at this point anyone is investing in the co-op for its tax efficiency, but co-op shares also are able to provide eligible dividends, which have a lower tax for investor, generally speaking, than either an ordinary dividend that a private company would issue or a nonprofit community bond. So all of these pieces on the technical side kind of made sense. And then it really spoke to this ethos of community building. You know, everyone is able to go cast their vote for your town council, give feedback on the municipal official plan, and that helps dictate how the city grows and change. But you don't have any input over what happens in the actual building, who the tenants are, whether or not they're paying fair prices. You know, so what if as a community, we extend that level of democracy and the co-op already had that democratic intent really built into its DNA. So it seemed like a great fit there for democratizing city building.
We asked John about Union Co-op's approach of purchasing existing housing stock rather than focusing on developing new housing units.
So in the future, there may be a development opportunity for Union Co-op, but we really want to focus on acquisitions for a few reasons. One is, at least in the region, no one else is doing it. You know, charities and the region are doing great work to build new affordable housing. And they have a goal right now of building 500 new units each year. Well, we're aware of one existing portfolio of below market rental apartments with 200 units that were sold this year to a profit maximizing investor. Almost certainly, those units are lost to our community as a form of market affordable housing. So we need somebody to step in, and nobody is working in that space right now. To build new, we're looking at anywhere from $300,000 to $400,000 a unit to build, whereas you can still buy an existing unit for, you know, $200,000 to $275,000 a unit. So there's also a price discount there. But the last piece is, I think this is a really important one, affordable, a lot of these older apartment buildings. So in Ontario, most of our purpose-built primary rental housing stock, so apartment buildings, were built before the 1980s. And a lot of these buildings are what are sometimes referred to as naturally occurring affordable housing units. So they were never purposefully built to be affordable housing, but they don't have granite top or stainless steel appliances. Instead, they have really long-term tenants. We looked at one property where a gentleman had lived there for 30 years, and a woman in that building lived there for 40 years. She raised her daughter in that building, and her daughter now lives on the floor above raising the woman's granddaughter. You know, we weren't able to preserve this property because it was too soon in our development. But this has been someone's home for, you know, longer than I've been alive. And I think she has a right to have that continue to be her home. So, you know, this is a type of property where, because of those long-term tenancies in Ontario, an existing tenant can only have their rent raised by the provincial guideline, which is roughly inflation. This year, I think it's 1.2% is what it can go up. So these long-term tenants are paying well below average market rents, so much so that that building that I was referring to with the two long-term tenants, the average rents for that building were cheaper than what CMHC would classify as affordable housing for a new affordable housing development in our region. That's a fantastic opportunity to preserve these existing rents, because if people like this are priced out of the market, then it creates more downward pressure on the rest of the housing system, making our housing crisis yet deeper.
So how does Union Co-op plan to generate revenue and potentially profit and dividends for its members? Sean explained their system and the costs involved in the service that the co-op will provide.
We charge rents just like any other housing provider. For us, though, the big difference with rents is, well, once we stabilize the property, we don't need to keep maximizing rents every time a tenant moves out. We can bring in a new tenant at largely the same rent that the previous tenant was paying because we're able to meet the mortgage, meet the repair costs. And so then for us, our big expenses are the actual operating costs of each property, as well as organizational costs like insurance. We have to get an audit every year. And then the remainder is paid out in dividends. So we have an internal policy that dividends are not to exceed prime plus 3%, which would be about 5.5% right now. We have not paid out a dividend yet as a startup organization, but that's what we're working towards. And we may supplement that with stock dividends, a combination of both cash and stock dividends. And it's something that has been advanced by renewable energy co-ops in Ontario now, of looking at paying out stock dividends as well. So that's where we're hoping to head.
Next, Sean talked about how Union Co-op attracts members to join the co-op to ensure that it has an impact now and in the future.
So we have been really fortunate. We had 60 members before our offering statement was approved back in May. And we thought, hey, you know, if we can get to 100, we'd be in a really good spot. Kind of a stretch goal. If we got 80, that would be good enough. And we're now approaching 170. And, you know, clearly we didn't set our ambitions high enough. That people in our community, and I'm sure this is the exact same across Canada, you know, they're hungry for the opportunity to have an impact, to help their neighbors, to make our communities more gentle and kind, fair spots to live. So with those individuals, a lot of them are coming through word of mouth. We've found a lot of folks through news articles, podcasts just like this, in raising awareness. And that's been really helpful. And we look to continue to grow. One of the really exciting pieces for us is, you know, when someone becomes a member, they now have skin in the game. And a lot of our community members are folks who probably have never lived in affordable housing, may never live in affordable housing. But their success, any return that they get, is predicated on the success of affordable housing more broadly. You know, now we have a group of 170 middle-class community members who have a very different voice that they can bring forward as well for these conversations around affordable housing. So I think long-term, that's a big benefit. So we do member information sessions. We do 4 a month, hour-long sessions for people to sign on, learn more about the co-op. We have our mailing list and social media that we use as well. We also provide scripts that our members can use to post on social media, but also to invite friends. And we've started doing kitchen table talks where members can essentially host their own information sessions, invite a few friends or family members, will virtually come on Zoom or Hangouts and talk about what the co-op does. And that's been really successful as well. You know, it feels different when you're hanging out with some friends. They're saying, this is something I'm involved in. I invited you because I thought you might be interested as well. And that's been really successful also.
Sean talked about the co-op's membership structure, how it works, and how much it costs to join and support the cooperative.
In Ontario, we have membership shares and preference shares. So one membership share costs $500. We wanted that to be low enough that it's accessible to a large number of people in the community, recognizing that, you know, for some folks, unfortunately, 500 is still a lot. But we wanted it high enough that also, you know, this isn't a credit union membership of $5, that people are really thinking about whether or not this is the right fit for them and their family. Yeah. And at this point, you know, all the admin is done by volunteers. So there's a transaction cost tied into membership. If we have 1,000 members, I think we're going to get tired just in terms of member relations there. So it's a tough trade-off where, you know, we want this to be accessible and community building, but we're also being realistic about our own limitations of what we can do right now and making sure that, you know, when folks are joining, they're thinking about this as a business. Because we have to be able to pay the mortgage, or else, you know, we're not able to provide good homes for people. So it's a tough trade-off there. What we are happy with is for our tenant members, there's no added cost. So generally speaking, tenants pay last month's rent when they get a new apartment. Last month's rent, part of that just pays the membership share. When they eventually leave the apartment to move on to a new opportunity, then they just surrender the share to the co-op, and that goes towards their last month's rent. We expect that the investments will mainly come from community members, but tenant members are certainly welcome to purchase preference shares. We don't have anything set for this yet, but, you know, I think there's so many opportunities here to continue to expand the model. For example, you know, a housing developer, a rental housing organization plans for a certain percentage of vacancy each year. So say we take our revenue that we know we can get if we were fully leased, and we assume that 2 to 3% of that we won't collect. We also assume that every unit will be paying, say, $750 or $800 a year on basic maintenance and repairs. Not the more significant replacements, but just basic maintenance and repairs. If after 5 years, somebody is still in that unit, it hasn't been vacant, and they've taken really good care of the unit, you know, that saved us a bunch of money. Could we actually be paying dividends to our tenant members? You know, could we be providing stock dividends to our tenant members that then they can sell to community members as a way of wealth transfer between community members and tenant members? There's all these different ways that we can explore how we can use the share structure to not just capitalize the co-op to buy new buildings, but also to, you know, recognize tenants and support them as well. Build equity, just like a homeowner would build equity. So right now, the way the co-op set up is actually, it's one membership group. So for changes to the articles or the bylaws, it's the entire membership that is required to hit the two-thirds voting threshold, which is a different than if we were a true multi-stakeholder co-op where there's actually separate membership groups, in part because we weren't sure what the first property would look like and the level of engagement from different types of tenant members. So there may be some opportunities to expand on that in the future, but there are dedicated board seats for the tenant members where the tenants elect those board seats. We have our model looks more like an opportunity development co-op or renewable energy co-op in the sense that the majority of the board seats are with the community members, those who are investing. In that way, we look a little bit like a charitable foundation or just a housing charity where people in the community with different skills, with expertise and capacity are looking to provide support. And then we have the tenant members, which makes us look more like a nonprofit housing co-op. We are looking at, you know, whether there may be opportunities in the future to move more to a community land trust style governance model where there's actually three separate groups of community members, tenant members, and then support organizations. So it could be our regional government, a big community foundation to balance out those interests. But at the moment, that's how our governance structure looks. We've been really lucky to have such great skills on our board and, you know, people who very much wear their hearts on their sleeves of who are very involved in the community in different ways. That's been helpful in terms of recruiting members. A lot of our directors have really deep roots in the community and are pulling on those roots in order to recruit new members. One of our directors, our board chair, actually works at the province of Ontario, overseeing a big chunk of what they call Ontario Works and Ontario Disability, but essentially welfare payments. So that expertise around the housing sector and government transfer has been helpful in terms of us thinking about, you know, what is affordable for the types of folks that we're supporting. We've been able to pull on lots of different experiences. As I mentioned, my partner, Alex, she's a founding member of a worker co-op brewery. She's also on the board. So having that co-op background is helpful. So in all of these areas, I think it shows the strength of a cooperative structure that we're able to rely on the expertise of our members. One piece that we are just moving towards now, because we're getting really close to buying our first two properties, is starting to set up some of these committees where, you know, so we'll have a maintenance, repair, and sustainability committee where we can actually look at the properties and plan out what our repair schedule is. And we know we have members who have a lot of expertise in energy retrofits and audits as contractors. So it's a way that we can engage members without them just being on the board, that the board is one set of governance decisions. But there's all sorts of other smaller decisions that can happen as well. And that's a really important piece. And the way Gay Lee describes their model is they have their board, but then they have regional committees as well that help influence or report back to the board, advise the board. In some ways, that's also a bit of a training ground for people who think about being directors, or for people who think, you know, I'm interested in the board, but I'm just not sure if I'm cut out to be a director. This is a way of encouraging people to get started, participate, know that, you know, you actually are really smart. You are really talented. You have that, that expertise you have is a value to the co-op. And maybe one day then they'll make that decision to run for the board. So hopefully this is a way of engaging people in those decisions of the co-op so that, you know, it's not as big of a jump, and they're already familiar with why we're doing things the way we are.
Members have a central, vital role in their cooperatives, and so it's important that they understand what a co-op is, how it works, and why it functions the way it does. To ensure that they have an engaged membership, Sean said it's important to educate them about co-ops and also to listen to what they need.
I think it's super important for any co-op to do that. For us, you know, we're working in a kind of complex space here of affordable housing and all the restrictions that come around that, but also the values, the passions involved with that, and finance. So these two things that don't always play nice together. And we have some members who have joined who have more of that finance brain, other members who are, you know, straight up housing activists. And we are ultimately restricted by what we can do based on, you know, legal frameworks, based on, you know, just cultural norms within the housing and real estate industry, based on our own cash flow. So there will be lots of trade-offs that we have to make, and staying focused on our values to make sure that those trade-offs are, as you know, as much as possible moving us in the direction we want to go, but being able to communicate that in a way that members understand why we went one way or another way, and that maybe they can also help us identify, you know, here's a better way. Expectation setting is hard, and you know, something of even that question of what is affordable. There are certainly people who are on more of the housing activist side who would say, you know, even if someone is disrupting other neighbors, there should never be a situation where anyone's evicted. You know, let's have talking circles. Let's look at this from a mediation standpoint. How do we help our neighbors from a position of love? You know, and then there's the legal requirements of what we have to do. So all of these pieces get really complex, but I think, you know, having so many different perspectives lets us really experiment here and try to find, you know, what is the best way and how do we move from being a landlord to being a housing provider.
So what comes next for Union Co-op? Sean talked about their plans and how they want to help others who want to start similar initiatives.
So we have one purchase agreement signed right now, hoping to close on that first property at the end of February, and looking at a second property potentially closing at the end of April. So both of those are really exciting opportunities for, you know, moving from what has been a long development stage of getting to this point where we're ready to go into actively piloting the model and helping people, of providing, you know, good forever homes that people can afford. I guess the other piece is that, you know, Union Co-op was always meant to focus on housing within Waterloo region. We have no empire building ambitions here, and we've been so fortunate to receive support from folks like you and from the Alberta ODCs, from the great work of the BC Cooperative Investment Community, and renewable energy co-ops, even down Northeast Investment Co-op in Minneapolis sent us documents right in the early days. So we'd be really happy and you know, thrilled to keep passing that along. And if anyone is interested in what we're doing, really happy to share documents, to have conversations, and to see if we can help them learn, and then ultimately learn from them and where they push the model.
Thank you for joining us. For more on us and what we do, visit cooperativesfirst.com. If you need resources for starting your own co-op, check out coopcreator.com. It's a great resource site that has everything you need to get a co-op up and running. To give us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode, you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, or on Twitter as coops_first. Join us next time on The Common Share.